I'm delighted to welcome Claire Rose, who is lecturer in contextual studies at the Royal College of Needlework. She is a historian of fashion, textiles, especially quilts, and childhood, and she specialises particularly in British history from 1750 to the present. Her research interests include history of crafts, especially dressmaking as well as quilt making, fashion history, and ethical fashion. Claire has collaborated on exhibitions with institutions like the Women's Library in London, the Victoria and Albert Museum, and the States Museums in Berlin. Her publications include Clothing, Society and Culture, Making, Selling and Wearing Boys' Clothes in Late Victorian England, both of those books that came out in 2010, and two articles, Continuity and Change in Children's Clothing, 1885 to 1920, and What Was Uniform About in the Founder's Sietka Sailor Suit. Both of these came out a couple of years ago. Her paper today is entitled Uniforms and Fashion in the Ready-to-Wear Clothing Industry Before 1914.
Thank you. It's a bit embarrassing to have all my publications read out. And I must say that most of my articles have been published by Textile History, and there is another one coming out. Those of you who have come across me before may know me as the expert on the juvenile sailor suit, which I'm trying to get away from, honestly, but it's a topic that keeps following me around. And in setting up this paper has really arisen out of research I did for my PhD, which is on juvenile clothing, on boys' clothing before 1900. And so I've put in a little bit about children's clothes and sailor suits, but there's really not time to go into that in detail. So if anyone does want to know more, I'd be happy to give you references. And I've got full references and sources on the last slides at the end, so you don't have to scribble too much. So today I'm going to be looking at the ready-to-wear clothing industry before 1914, which is an area that is really, really, really under-researched in spite of all the great work that's going on in textile history and being done by people, some of whom are in this room, like Laura. So I'm going to start by just setting out the situation with the clothing industry in mid-19th century Britain. Now, I've got to make a major disclaimer here. I am not a historian of military uniforms. So if I get any of that wrong, you'll just have to tell me about it later. But one of the things that I realised in doing the work for Clothing and Culture, which looked at clothing documents throughout the 19th century, was how closely related the early ready-to-wear, the origins of the ready-to-wear clothing trade and military clothing were in Britain. And this is a very rare and very important document from 1850. It is a mail order catalogue from 1850 with illustrations for Higham and Co., who were, if you've heard of Moses and Son, Higham and Co. were their more upmarket rivals. They had, by 1850, they had branches in London, Birmingham, Newcastle, Glasgow, Liverpool, Manchester, and were looking at expanding into the colonies. Mr. Higham had a lot of sons. He was very clever that way. And what interests me about this catalogue is the way that it uses military styling in children's clothes. And so here you have a page of clothes for boys from toddler to adolescent, and the adolescents are dressed in more or less conventional men's suits, except the jacket's a bit different. But the younger boys have a jacket and then a tunic, that's a hip-length tunic to be worn, probably over a skirt, actually, which are made to look a little bit more masculine by this kind of military braiding based on the hussar uniform, and I will be coming back to that later. And in the 1850s, what you find when you look at the documents around the clothing industry is that shops or retailers often operate on several levels. So Higham had retail outlets, they did mail order, they were also manufacturers, and if not Higham, then some of their rivals were also involved in contract clothing. And contract clothing was clothing made in enormous batches for institutions. Now, these institutions might be workhouses, they might be prisons, or they might actually be army regiments. It's very difficult to find out about these because the documents are very scattered, and also because in some cases there's a bit of doublethink going on, so that, for example, prisons and workhouses will claim that their clothes are made inside in order to keep costs down, but actually very often they're bought in. And one of Higham's rivals, Arthur Lines, in the 1870s, had an advertisement in the back of his mail order catalogue saying specifically, we will make contract clothing for institutions. We also know that army uniforms in particular were part of the sweated clothing system, because when Mayhew was interviewing garment workers for his Lives in London, the Morning Chronicle articles, he actually interviewed a sweated out worker who was doing the gold embroidery for military uniforms, which is a very skilled trade. I mean, I teach students who are learning this, and it takes hours to learn these skills. And yet, this man was being paid below subsistence wages as an out worker for Nickel & Co., which is how I honed in on it, because I'm looking at nickel. So that nickel were being contracted to produce army uniforms, and they were subcontracting out the more skilled parts of the work, the gold work. So that the whole situation is actually quite complex. Now, to go very, very briefly through sailor suits, what I found when I started looking at boys' clothes before 1900 was that for young boys aged between about 3 and 8, the standard item was the sailor suit. I mean, every middle-class boy and many working-class boys would have had a sailor suit in their wardrobe, and many of them would have actually had several sailor suits, in fact, a complete wardrobe of sailor suits. And how the sailor suit arose is actually very interesting, because there's this myth, and we talk about myths at coffee break, that this comes out of the famous portrait of Edward, Prince of Wales, in naval uniform, 1846. The portrait exists. It was definitely noticed in the press. It was much reproduced. That's not where the juvenile sailor suit comes from. The juvenile sailor suit arises around this time, which is an 1875 portrait of the children of Edward, Prince of Wales, the Wales children, on holiday at Cowes, Isle of Wight, where the three sons and the two daughters have been dressed in sailor outfits. Sorry, three daughters, two sons have been dressed in sailor outfits for their seaside holiday. And this is when the sailor suit starts to be a fashion item. And in fact, Redfern of Cowes, who probably provided these outfits, launched themselves as international couturiers on the basis of this. And the sailor suit very quickly takes off and becomes an absolutely central item in the ready-to-wear clothing industry. And this is a poster for a single season's range from a London wholesaler in 1886. And I've counted there are 8 different kinds of sailor suits in this poster. And this is just one retailer. So they were absolutely central. But what is apparent when you look closely is that it's the younger boys in the front line who are wearing sailor suits. There are a few old boys' outfits, but it's mostly for younger boys. And when I went on from looking at the garment industry to look at evidence of use, I found something very interesting, which was that although sailor suits were available for older boys, they were predominantly worn by younger boys. And I looked at a lot of school group photographs, which are dated, and you can also divide them at least into infants and juniors, so under 8 and 8 to 12 or 8 to 10. The sailor suit was absolutely normative for boys in state infant schools, but it was not uniform. It's a very important distinction. School uniforms did not exist in the 95% of schools that were state-run. They only existed in the tiny, tiny fraction of private schools such as Eton, with, you know, 10 scholars a year. So that what you're seeing here is boys who have been dressed in sailor suits, which have been produced by the ready-to-wear clothing industry and purchased from high street retailers. And here's the other end of the equation, which is the manufacturers. And this is a very, very important manufacturer called John Barron and Son of Leeds. And what you're looking at is a rather fuzzy reproduction of a registered design from the Board of Trade archives at the National Archives. Barron registered hundreds of designs for boys' outfits, most of which were sailor suits. And what he registered was not the shape itself, but the trimming. So that the sailor suit is important less as a garment and more as a kind of surface that you can put trimming on. And in many cases, the registration consists of just this little corner here showing the trimming. So what he's registering is the trimming on the collar. This one with the flowers, very nice, gold braid flowers on dark-coloured wool or cotton velvet. He also registered Art Nouveau designs, shell designs, Celtic knots. You name it, you could have it on your sailor suit. Okay, so that what I came to the conclusion that the sailor suit for boys, it did have some kind of tangential link to actual naval practices, but it was very much distanced from military or naval uniform by several factors. Firstly, by the fact that the boys who wore juvenile sailor suits were demonstrably too young to join the Navy. You couldn't join the Navy till you were 13 or 14, by which time you might just have hit puberty. So that they are demonstrably too young to be sailors. They are wearing not regulation sailor suits, but fashionable sailor suits in velvet, sailor suits in striped fabric, sailor suits in cotton, and they're also wearing this year's sailor suit with this year's fashionable trimming. So moving on from that, I thought I would have a look and see if any of these elements are true of military-styled outfits or military garb for women. And the other thing that I'd like to say is that for sailor suits, the advantages of the sailor suit are multiple. The sailor suit is great for mothers. I don't know if any of you have dressed a small child this morning, but the sailor blouse is so loose-fitting, it's a bit like a sweatshirt. And the kid puts its arms up and the sailor suit goes over the head. And it's brilliant because if you buy little Johnny a sailor suit and it's a bit big for him and he grows into it, that's not going to show. With other types of garments, that's going to show. So for mothers of families, the sailor suit is brilliant. For manufacturers, the sailor suit is great because you can push out maybe 3 or 4 stock sizes, fits everybody, and because you can vary your designs by varying the trimming. Okay. Now, military uniforms are a little bit different because one of the distinctive identifiers of military uniforms before 1914 was that they were generally very close-fitting. And we have here John Thompson's picture of recruiting sergeants at the Mitre and Dove in Westminster. And what you can see is how absolutely glove-fitting these jackets are. And there's even a suspicion that these recruiting sergeants are posing standing up because it might have been quite difficult for them to sit down. There are any number of cartoons about fashionable army officers whose clothes are so tight-fitting that they're less able to bend down than fashionable women were. And the other thing that we forget, or I don't know, we might forget, about army uniforms before 1914, certainly before 1900, was how flashy and striking they were. And there are even comments about women being upstaged by military men in dress uniform, because these tunics were all bright scarlet, and then there would have been contrasting accoutrements like the belts. There would have been shiny brass buttons and, of course, gold braid and rank badges. And so the uniforms, although they followed that idea of uniformity, they were also very visually striking. And then, of course, the other thing with the British Army, to some extent now, but much more so before 1900, was the variety within uniforms, so that this sergeant here is clearly part of a Hussars regiment because he has these stripes of braid across his chest, and that anyone looking at them who knew about uniforms would actually be able to tell which regiment they belonged to by the details of what they were wearing. And the uniform was a tool, it was a propaganda tool for the army, and it was used to attract new recruits. These men were actually working on commission, and they wore their best, their smartest uniform as a way of getting the recruits to sign up. And looking at the British Army, I don't have so many texts for that, but there's a wonderful quotation from Alison Matthews David's article on the French Army about the extravagant colours and details of some of these uniforms. And this is the French hussars with their fur-lined coats, jackets, skin-tight breeches in showy colours and many hues, sky blue, maroon, silver grey, light green, royal blue, dark green, adorned with tresses, that would be plaits of gold cord, embroidery, braids, stripes, fourragère, their silk belts in lively shades, coiffed with their colbacks, which were special hats of Astrakhan fur. These young men, well cinched in their fashionable uniforms, had a truly proud air. So there's a distinct air of display here, particularly for the Hussars, who are an elite cavalry regiment who kind of summed up everybody's idea of the most glamorous army uniform. Now, going alongside that was the need to maintain some kind of uniformity. And I'll be using in this paper documents produced for tailors. And tailors' documents are very interesting because the tailor is having to produce garments for the middle-class client. I mean, and they are very much middle-class clients. But they're also having to conform with regulations and with what is, broadly speaking, fashionable. So there's a lot of very interesting comments in there. And this is from W.G.F. Vincent's The Cutting of Military Garments. W.G.F. Vincent was the leading authority on tailoring in the late 19th century, early 20th century, and wrote for The Tailor and Cutter and also published these part works, which were used by every bespoke tailor. And so he starts by making a distinction between officers' uniforms and rank-and-file uniforms, which is 99% of the army. It will, of course, be understood that we are here treating of the dress of officers only, the uniform of the rank and file being provided for them by the government and is made for them, either at the Royal Army Clothing Factory, Pimlico, or by some of the various contractors who make a speciality of this kind of dress. So when this book was published after 1901, because it refers to the new king, contractors were still in force. And the contracting out system was very controversial because not only did it tend to lead to sweating and exploitation of the workers, because of the way that the contracts were issued, there was a tendency for some of the funds to get skimmed off by the army officers who were letting the contracts. And certainly in the Crimea, the contracted uniforms were so substandard that soldiers were dying of cold because their uniforms were so appallingly made. apparently in the Crimea, when anyone died, they would immediately raffle what remained of his uniform because people needed it in order to keep warm. Anyway, Vincent on the regulations. At the War Office, the sealed garments for nearly every rank and variety of service may be inspected. This is arranged by government to facilitate uniformity in the garments of the officers. Consequently, the attendant in charge will, as a rule, do all in his power to give the information necessary and even allow a rubbing to be taken of any particular section of braiding or embroidery. So this is a system where the officers are having their clothes made individually to their specific measurements, but the tailors are at the same time having to comply with regulations down to the detail of the fitness and the placement of the embroidery. Now, looking at the evidence for military styling in the ready-to-wear trade, as I've said, I've not been able to look at the contracting system and the contracting out. So what I'm looking at is the fashion trade. And what struck me immediately is that military styling is being used in rather a similar way to naval styling as a way of kind of smartening up rather standardised mass-produced garments. So here's part of a set of garments registered by John Barron and Son of Leeds in 1882. There were 15 different little boys' jackets registered on this day. And this is extraordinary because these are photographs of actual garments that had actually been produced. And you have a variety of different kinds of trimming, but including this rather flashy kind of hussar-influenced braiding down the front of a jacket that looks as if it's made of cotton velvet. But from what I've seen of Barron, this garment would, like the sailor suits, have been produced in sizes for boys who are well under the age of puberty. So again, it's a kind of fantasy garment for little boys. Here's another registered design. This is a drawing, but I presume based on actual patterns made by Buckley and Son of Leeds in 1880. And here they've got this broad strips of braid bent back on themselves, which I think is an artillery. Artillery? I think it relates to one of the specific regiments of the British Army, but as I said, I'm unfortunately not an expert in army uniforms. And what I like about this is that it shows you the trousers that go with the jacket, and they are very definitely short trousers. So again, that tells us that this is an outfit that's going to be produced in sizes to fit boys aged maybe 6 or 7 up to 11 or 12 when they might be going into long trousers. Okay. Now, looking at military design for ladies, military trimming on women's fashionable clothes has come in and out of fashion for centuries, as a matter of fact. And in the 1820s, there was a real fashion for hussar-style braiding across the front of women's bodices and police overcoats. And in fact, the name police comes from one of the garments worn by hussars. But what interests me is the interaction between this kind of decoration and trimming and the growth of ready-to-wear. Now, although women's ready-to-wear wasn't quite so well developed before 1900 as men's and boys' ready-to-wear, it was very definitely present. And when you look in the archives, you can see evidence of it. For example, here is an ensemble that was offered ready-to-wear or made to measure by the Army and Navy Stores of London, and it's called the Royal Horse Artillery Costume. So it's aligned with a specific military regiment, and it is remarkably high priced. At £6.15, 1892, That's about 7 weeks' wages for working men. Okay? Women's wages in the 1890s, it's hard to say, but most women would have been on about 10 shillings a week. So it is a high-priced costume. And costume in 1900 means specifically a woman's tailored ensemble. Now, that was a ready-to-wear piece. What do the tailors say about it? Well, there's a writer on tailoring called Thornton who wrote a wonderful book aimed at tailors, telling them all they need to know about cutting garments for ladies, including cycling breeches and how to measure a lady's inside leg. Basically, you get her to sit down, you measure the outside leg, and then you measure the side of her hip, and then you subtract. And Thornton, what I find interesting about his book is the comments to the tailor on the kind of rationale behind what he's doing. So he talks here about why braiding is good for the tailor. The great variety of ornamental braiding and tracing, now so popular on almost all descriptions of ladies' garments, has suggested the advisability of including in this work a few suggestions for such decoration. This department of the business is one in which the tailor of artistic tastes has a splendid opportunity to indicate his ability. He is not tied down to any stereotyped features like his fellow craftsmen engaged in the gentleman's department, whose most extravagant essay in ornamentation is the introduction of flat braid and silk breast facings. He can introduce colours into his trimming, from the most subdued to those whose tones are as brazen as a Salvation Army brass band. He can select any form or character of design, ranging from the hieroglyphics on Cleopatra's needle to the crow's toes on a militiaman's jumper. And the jumper is a loose tunic rather than a knitted garment. And here are some designs proposed by Thornton. And he talks about the second design, this one, the top right, the cuirass braiding. Of course, cuirass was a metal breastplate worn by mounted officers. This design, at first sight, appears as it really is, rather heavy, but tastes are very divergent. And as an ornamentation to a winter jacket for a lady of the dashing type, it may be described as appropriate. The lady who may select this style of trimming will doubtless think more of a dragoon, as a mounted officer, or a lion tamer, than a curate, or, we say it with all due respect, a tailor. So he's implying that women are dressing themselves up like this in order to imitate and also to attract the most dashing and glamorous cavalry officers, or perhaps lion tamers, who would be distinctly a different class fraction to the ladies who are going to be going to Thornton's for their clothes. And these garments, however, as well as being available through the bespoke trade, were also available in the ready-to-wear trade. And this is a very interesting document. It's a publicity leaflet for fashion retailers. Now, I must just quickly explain what these are. Clements Newling Limited were commercial printers who made publicity leaflets. And although this one has the name of a specific firm, J.H. Allen & Co., these are generic, and you can tell that because down the side it says number 592, spring and summer season, circular 1892, and it actually gives you the prices, depending on whether you order 500, 1,000 or 5,000. They're broadly similar to, and it's a horrible analogy, those pizza flyers you get through your door, you know, with the details of your local pizza delivery firm in a box on the back. But what's interesting about them as evidence of the fashion industry is that because they are generic and designed to be sold to a number of retailers throughout the country, they have to represent the styles that these retailers were probably going to be able to supply. And I'm afraid the work hasn't yet been done to say what happens if you go into J.H. Allen & Co. asking for this new diagonal cut bodice and they don't have it. I don't know. But anyway, what we see here is a lady's jacket, not a tailored costume, but a jacket worn with a non-matching skirt. And again, we have these tags of braid, which are a military reference. But I think quite interestingly, they've been put on top of a garment that's otherwise very, very plain and almost certainly mass-produced and ready to wear. And I'm sorry that this slide is rather indistinct. It's a scan of a printout, which was itself taken from a microfilm. Here we have another level down, if you like, of the women's clothing trade. This is a woman's jacket, and I hope you can see the detail here. It has, again, that hussar-style braiding across the front, but again, it's a jacket that's not part of an ensemble but made to be worn with a non-matching skirt, and it's actually made of knitted fabric, of jersey. Now, this would definitely be a cheaper item because it wouldn't have to fit. You know, it's a kind of stretchy thing. You put it on, it's more or less one size fits all. And this was registered by Hilda and Godbold, who I think were wholesalers based in Leicester Square. But the actual status of these firms is a little bit fluid because I haven't yet been able to do the research on them. What is interesting, however, is that it's the illustration itself is by a woman called Annette Claxton, whose married name was Annette Turner, who was the most prominent fashion artist of her day. So that if she's illustrating it, then it does represent something that's very much in fashion. And this is from 1883. Military-style braiding as a product. I don't know if any of you have ever been down Berwick Street in Soho. No. The descendants of this firm are still there. Trimming shops with a notice on the door saying, trade only. This is a dressmaker's supply stores in Aldersgate, which of course is in the East End. It's in the centre of the clothing industry. It's where Moses set up their first shop. And what they are offering is sets of military-style trimmings to be put onto garments. And they're actually quite expensive. This is 6 shillings for the collar and yoke. This one, I'm sorry, I can't read the detail. But the cost of these would then have to be added to the cost of the garment itself. And again, this is a registered publicity leaflet from the National Archives from 1900. And the size of, or the importance of braiding as a commercial product can be deduced from this, which is a translation by Alison Matthews David, or a report on the French exhibits at the 1889 International Exhibition, which says, passementerie is excessively widely used. In addition to the delicate ornaments it makes for women's dress, this industry produces very great quantities of braid in silk and wool for edging men's garments. In military uniforms, it is for epaulettes, frogging, striped stars, which mark the ranks. Gold braid plays a very important role. So here you have military trimmings not only being used as a device to sell fashionable garments, you also have, and to sell garments produced through the ready-to-wear industry, you also have the production of military trimmings as an industry in themselves. Okay. Now, what I found when I looked at sailor suits was that the attitude and the use of juvenile sailor suits is really thrown into relief, if you like, by what happens in the Boer War, which started in 1899. And I think there's something a little bit similar going on in women's wear, because in 1899-1900, the Boer War was going very well, the relief of Mafeking and so on. There were a lot of volunteer regiments going out. There was, I can't remember their name, but there was a particular set of volunteers from the City of London who went off with great fanfare. And in the Copy One archives of commercial documents, there are endless, endless adverts trading on the Boer War in the crassest possible way. For example, the Baden-Powell boot polish, complete with a picture of Baden-Powell. Yes, totally unauthorised. Khaki creams, confectionery, made by Roundtree's. Sorry, not by Roundtree's, by Backhouse of York. So one would expect to see patriotic themes flagged up in clothing, and you do, but what you see is not the use of sailor suits or military braiding as a patriotic theme in dress. We see the new form of uniform, which is khaki. And khaki, it's a Hindi word meaning dust-coloured or dust, actually originated in the Indian Army, the British Army in India, but it was adopted first semi-officially and then officially in the Boer War, because the Boer War was a guerrilla war, and the red or tartan regular uniforms were actually dangerous. And so khaki had to be adopted as a way of lessening fatalities. And this obviously got back to Britain, because there were a lot of war reporters out in South Africa. And it's khaki that is flagged up as the new fashion trend of 1900. So you have khaki sailor suits. Seriously. Khaki sailor suits complete with the volunteer hats, based on the hats worn by the City of London volunteers. Or you have this fabric, which is khaki fabric, being sold as a new fashion line. This is the label to put on the fabric, and here you have a picture of one of our gallant boys in khaki, somewhere else in the belt. And interestingly, it's being specified as suitable for suits, which would be for men, and costumes, which is for ladies. And as I've mentioned, there were also things like khaki creams, confectionery, probably coffee-flavoured. And we have here Vesta Tilly, who's a very, very important character on the music hall stage. This is, I think, a slightly later portrait, but it shows the difference of the kind of physique and the presentation of the new style uniforms from the old style. And looking ahead, what happens when World War I starts is that the military references that are used in fashion are not the references to the hussar suit, they're not the references to the braiding and to all that glamour. They are references more to the clothes that are actually being worn, to the service tunics and simply cut, not trousers, but simply cut skirts. And so it seems as if the decorative military references are kept in a separate box, if you like. They're somehow understood as being different from day-to-day military gear. And there are several reasons, I think, why this might be the case. One is that until the 1960s, there was an offence on the statute box of on the statute book of impersonating a British officer. In 1966, when I was Lord Kitchener's valet, had just moved to Carnaby Street because they were doing such great business in selling off military bandsmen's uniforms, someone was actually prosecuted in the courts for impersonating a member of Her Majesty's forces because he bought one of these jackets and was wearing it down the street. And the judge actually threw it out because he said no one could, you know, mistake this long-haired layabout who's probably wearing jeans for a member of the army. But the offence was still on the statute books. So I think that there's a very pragmatic reason, if you like, why these decorative uniforms were the ones that were taken on. It's because these aren't ones that you would expect to see people wearing. they do represent the most glamorous and the most aesthetically pleasing aspect of menswear. And there's something a little bit subversive about them too, particularly when you think of military bandsmen, who would very often have risen up through the ranks, but had these absolutely gorgeous uniforms. For my PhD, I looked extensively at the Barnardo's archive, and the Barnardo's boys who did well and wrote back to tell the orphanage how well they'd done, very often they went in to the military band. And I have been posted to South Africa, I have been mentioned in dispatches, I have had a promotion, I am now a sergeant, and here is a picture of me in my uniform to reproduce in your magazine. Yeah? So that it was actually, the bandsman's uniform was something that people, that ordinary working men could aspire to, whereas they're never going to get to wear a hussar officer's uniform. And I've got a final picture I'm going to show you, but first I'm just going to run through, these are the sources I've used, W.D.F. Vincent, who, as I've said, has written practically everything, and Thornton, Sectional System of Ladies' Garment Cutting, 1900, the Army and Navy Stores brochure, and then just a brief reference to the Board of Trade and Stationers' Hall archives, which I have discussed in much more detail in my articles, which I have here. But I think, looking back over the literature, what I find most helpful in understanding the links between fashion and military uniforms in Britain is Alison Matthews David's work on French soldiers. And interestingly, the French army, not having to fight in South Africa, went into World War I with red tunics. Sorry, red trousers and blue tunics in World War I. And it was only when they realised what that was doing to their mortality rates that they finally changed it. Also, the red trousers were made of dye that was produced in Berlin. Not great, really not great. Anyway, I thought you'd all like to see this as a final image. Wonderful. Completely wonderful and completely typical of what bandsmen in wedding bands wear in Rajasthan.